Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast in the New Books Network. My name is Derek Litvak, and I'll be your host. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Catherine A. Stewart about her book, Long Past Slavery, Representing Race in the Federal Writers Project, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2016. Dr. Stewart is a professor of history at Cornell College. Long Past Slavery examines the history behind the collection of more than 2,300 narratives from formerly enslaved people as part of the New Deal's Federal Writers Project. Stewart pays close attention to how the ex-slave narratives represented a site of contestation between many people who had competing visions for what America's past looked like and what the future could hold. From Black interviewers to members of the United Daughters of the Confederacy to formerly enslaved people themselves, Stewart illustrates how these narratives were battleground over national memory, Black identity, and Black citizenship. Dr. Stewart, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Derek, and thank you for your interest in my work.
Yeah, so I guess to get things started, could you tell our listeners how you became interested in this project and why you wanted to study it?
Well, there's a long answer, a short answer to that question. So which do you want, long or short?
I guess go ahead and give us the long story, you know, take us on a journey.
All right. This goes back to my days in graduate school at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And I had been casting about, kind of looking in different areas, casting about for a dissertation topic. And I think as many people who are in that position, you know, ABD, all but dissertated, working on trying to figure out where they should go with their first kind of attempt at a major scholarly project, I was really kind of feeling like I was flailing about. And I'd been exploring different things, but one of the things that I was kind of interested in was this idea of kind of anthropological or ethnographic encounters. So I'd been taking a couple of graduate courses in specifically culture and theory, where we read The Predicament of Culture by James Clifford. And at the same time, I was also taking a course on kind of the domestic culture of imperialism with a British historian, Kathleen Wilson. And at the same time, then I was taking a course with Matthew Jacobson, who was then a professor at SUNY Stony Brook. He's now at Yale. And he was teaching a wonderful course on Cold War science fiction film. And I was really intrigued, you know, by kind of having this kind of intersecting ideas about culture and power and how it operates in different kind of national contexts. So what really intrigued me in thinking about anthropology and this idea of kind of cultures of domestic imperialism and this idea of kind of Cold War film was the specific engagement or relationship between the anthropologist field worker and the people who are acting as informants, as local informants. And I think, you know, people who are hearing this and maybe familiar with my book or who are going to be looking at my book, you'll see that kind of those ideas about power, the power that's riven throughout those conversations and that process of the anthropologist gathering information from local informants, that it's riven with power and intimacy and then also kind of vast elements of inequality in that relationship really comes through then in kind of how I'm reading the ex-slave narratives and the ways in which those encounters were also taking place between Federal Writers Project employees who were working as interviewers and formerly enslaved African Americans who were being interviewed as kind of local informants. So I was just interested in kind of what happens in these encounters and why are they so charged in various ways. So that was kind of the foundation, if you will, or the framework, I guess the lens that was kind of set in place in my graduate studies. And then one of my advisors suggested that I take a look at the WPA slave narrative collection. And it wasn't a collection I was familiar with, and I hadn't actually done any reading on it yet. And I took a look at those narratives, and they just really leapt right off the page. For anyone who takes a look at them, and I would encourage all of your listeners, if they haven't, and even if they have, take a deeper look at that collection. It's available through the Library of Congress website online, so it's easy to get a hold of these days. But if you look at those narratives, you will see how vivid they are and how much kind of the different personalities and the different characters come forward, not just in terms of the formerly enslaved African Americans who are being interviewed, but also even in some cases, certainly is the case with the Georgia narratives, the character of the interviewer as well. And so they're kind of really a great microcosm, I don't know, site for looking at these relationships of power in an attempt to kind of gain and collect information about African Americans' experience during enslavement, and certainly also an interest in collecting Black folk culture through this narrative, slave narrative project.
And yeah, and so speaking about these sources, can you kind of give our listeners a little bit more about, you know, what these sources are and particularly how they came to be? Because I think for people who are, you know, not familiar with the Federal Writers Project or the ex-slave narratives, they might be wondering, like, okay, like, how did this even come about? You know, this massive repository of slave narratives as part of this, just one part of this larger project going on. And so how did this come to be?
Mm-hmm. It is an astonishing history, and that's really why I was so interested in kind of looking further into the project. So when I was looking at the narratives themselves and just kind of poking around, there's over 2,300 individual interviews that were conducted in various states with formerly enslaved African Americans. And when you look just at the narratives themselves, you know, a number of them are quite short. Some of them are only 2 to 3, 3 to 4 pages. You'll see that there's great variation in both content and also in style, or kind of the format in which they were presented. So if you're looking at the content, one of the things that kind of jumped out at me is the fact that a number of formerly enslaved African Americans, as you might expect, are talking about the brutality of enslavement. And they're talking about the violence of the system that they personally experienced and witnessed, and the trauma of that experience. So that doesn't seem so surprising, I think, to historians today. But if you also look more broadly through the collection, you'll also find narratives from formerly enslaved African Americans that seem to express kind of a longing for what they call the good old days of slavery. And there's a certain nostalgia that comes through in certain narratives where informants are talking about kind of their beloved masters and mistresses, and kind of this benevolent view of the institution of slavery. So that surprised me, you know, in looking at the narratives, that you would have such divergent perspectives from formerly enslaved African Americans on the institution. And then the other thing that surprised me was really kind of the format in which they were presented. So again, there's a great variety in the kind of over 2,300 interviews you can look at. A number of them were done as kind of brief biographical sketches, kind of what formerly enslaved African Americans had done following emancipation and the ways in which they'd made great efforts to gain education and rise in the world. A number of the other ones are written as first-person narratives, as if they were really written directly in the voice of the former slave themselves. And so those first-person narratives sometimes, too, are written with a type of phoneticized kind of spelling or attempt to recreate kind of what Southern white writers very often thought of as the Black vernacular, trying to recreate that on the page. Some of the interviews also include kind of the questions and the answers, not just kind of the narrative of the former slave. And they have this very often the setup where the interviewer actually talks about approaching the house of the former slave and kind of their own observations about the African-American informant whom they're going to interview. So again, it was just such a wide variety in this rich collection. So I think what's astounding about this collection is that it is the largest collection of ex-slave testimony that was gathered in the United States. And that it was gathered so late, I think, is certainly a disappointment and shocking. But the fact that it was gathered at the last possible minute, quite literally, the last possible decade in which you would still have a generation of African Americans who had been enslaved and who could tell and report and give testimony firsthand, witnessing, if you will, about the experience of enslavement was quite important in the 1930s. So the project came about as part of the WPA, that stands for the Works Projects Administration, also known as the Works Progress Administration. And most people have heard of the WPA. They normally, I think, when associate it with kind of back to work projects. The Roosevelt administration during the Great Depression was really trying to find creative ways to put Americans back to work. And a lot of the ways they came up with were specifically rebuilding American infrastructure. So when people think of the WPA, they think of, you know, guys leaning on shovels. I think they think of, you know, projects to build roads and schools and bridges, public recreation areas. And that's something that the WPA was very much involved with. But another, I think, really important aspect of the WPA that people often forget about were the cultural projects. And the Roosevelt administration had this kind of radical idea of trying to find and create employment for unemployed Americans in occupations where they had formerly been employed. So the idea is you don't take a writer and give them a shovel, tell them to start digging a ditch. Rather, you try to create a series of art projects that can put unemployed writers, artists, even theater professionals back to work in the occupation that they're best suited for. So part of those arts projects included the Federal Writers Project. And the Federal Writers Project, or the FWP, you know, there's all those acronyms from the Roosevelt administration's kind of alphabet agencies. But the FWP specifically was focusing on trying to come up with projects for unemployed writers so that they could also get back to work. The FWP was regarded at the time as kind of the ugly duckling of the cultural arts projects of the WPA. I think that's because the American public really kind of regarded unemployed writers with a certain amount of perhaps healthy skepticism, but really saw them very often as kind of slackers on the relief rolls. You know, it was kind of an ill-defined category, amorphous category of who constituted a professional writer. So there were a lot of ways in which kind of the FWP was looked down upon at the time. And you can look at kind of press clippings and publicity clippings that appear in major media of the time, really, again, casting this kind of critical glance, looking askance, if you will, at the work that the Federal Writers Project was undertaking. So the FWP started off as this attempt to kind of come up with a project, the director of the FWP, Henry Ellsberg, to come up with a project that would put unemployed writers back to work and yet find a project that could somehow be something that all Americans could see the value of, something that would not be considered highly politicized. You know, during that time period, during the Great Depression, when all of these New Deal programs that are coming about were really revolutionary for the time period and really kind of inciting, if you will, quite a bit of conservative critique and pushback against Roosevelt's ideas about how to bring the economy back from the brink of this economic crisis. So actually, if you don't mind, I would love to read you, and I promise it's the only thing I'm going to read, but I'd love to read you this quote from Time Magazine about what they had to say about the Federal Writers Project. It really sums up, I think, kind of the public attitude towards the Federal Writers Project in this time. So this is Time Magazine from the 1930s. They described the Federal Writers Project as, quote, a mazy mass of unemployed newspapermen, poets, graduates of schools of journalism who had never had jobs, authors of unpublished novels, high school teachers, people who had always wanted to write, and a sprinkling of first-rate professional writers who were down on their luck, unquote. And I think you can see from that quote the ways in which the public really was not embracing this notion of a cultural project that was going to put writers back to work. So the FWP is best known, I think, still today for the American Guide series. And that was the first project that Henry Alsberg came up with, the director of the FWP. And it was something that he thought was needed at the time, and it could serve multiple purposes. So the American Guide series was meant to be a series of guidebooks that would be carried out at the local and state level in all of the states of the United States that would create guidebooks specifically kind of that would be helpful to the tourist, people who it was hoping to promote tourism at a time when Americans wouldn't necessarily have the funds to go farther afield, and also kind of reboot local economies by, you know, hoping to promote tourism in those areas. And it was really drawing upon kind of, if you will, the strengths and the local knowledge of writers in different geographical areas in different regions, who would be able to kind of tell through their own lens, their personal history and kind of the history of their town or their community or their state in kind of vivid terms. So it was called kind of a national, it was their first attempt at a national Baedeker series for the United States. And it did end up becoming quite a successful undertaking for the FWP. Many people were employed working on the American Guide series. A number of the American Guide books are still in print today. So even though they're out of date, obviously, in terms of where to go and kind of what you might find in different areas, because they're all from the 1930s perspective, they're still valued as a really important cultural resource, recording kind of the nation and different elements of regional culture in this time period that show up in the American Guide series. But the Ex-Slave Project, which I think is really the major contribution of the FWP, and its kind of, astounding success, really came about as a result of this other project. So the American Guide series was all about kind of going out, gathering local stories, surveying also flora and fauna, but also giving some sense of the different ethnic groups that live in different regions, along with kind of longer histories of those states and those areas. And specifically, the Federal Writers Project, a number of those interviewers who are employed in this also began interviewing elderly inhabitants. And that was one of the things suggested by federal directors, you know, that writers should go out, they should start in their communities, they should look for elderly residents who would have good stories to tell about the old days, that elderly residents of various areas could be really important resources for gathering historical information and also cultural information that could be included in the guide series. And so part of that then came about from people deciding to interview formerly enslaved African Americans, who were obviously very elderly at this time period and would have been the oldest inhabitants in many regions. And the stories that they had to tell then about the experience of their enslavement, but also the stories that they had to tell about emancipation and their lives as freedmen and freed women. And those interviews with African Americans caught the attention then of the federal directors like Henry Alsberg, when they were forwarded on from the state offices then to the federal offices in Washington, D.C. And Henry Alsberg and his associate, George Cronin, were so taken with the immediacy of this oral testimony from formerly enslaved African Americans that they felt that this was a project that should be undertaken in its own right, and not just as this kind of supplementary element to the American Guide series, but something that could yield kind of a treasure trove and an important repository, if you will, of African-American folk culture and traditions that were dying out in this time period with the encroachment of mass media and mass culture, and that you could also then record, importantly, the firsthand testimony of the last generation of African-Americans who could speak firsthand with firsthand knowledge about their experience of slavery and emancipation. So that's kind of how it came about. But I just want to emphasize, I'm still struck when I look back at this, That it was such a revolutionary undertaking, I think, for the federal government in this time period. And I think all of the arts projects were revolutionary, certainly in terms of the history of the United States federal government deciding finally to put some major money and funding into cultural projects and recording the cultural history of the nation as, you know, of seminal importance in this time period. But really revolutionary in terms of the Federal Writers Ex-Slave Project. Revolutionary undertaking in the 1930s during a time period of Jim Crow segregation to have employees of the Federal Writers Project go out and collect again, really for the first time in any wide-scale attempt to do so, the firsthand testimony of formerly enslaved African Americans. It was also revolutionary in terms of again, kind of as I was talking about those anthropological encounters of bringing together people to speak across kind of the color line or across the great divide created by Jim Crow and segregation, you know, bringing Southern whites kind of sitting down, literally sitting down at the same table, sitting down in the same on the same porch with formerly enslaved African Americans and trying to speak across that divide of race. But also trying to speak across divides based upon class, divides based upon education levels, kind of these various divisions, trying to bring Americans together to talk about the still highly charged subject of enslavement and emancipation. So it's just a revolutionary project in so many ways, and also a really seminal moment in that African Americans were really, for the first time, being invited to contribute their voices, to contribute their perspective, to contribute their knowledge in the creation of a new archive that would be about the history of enslavement and emancipation, and to contribute their voices and their skills and their talents as writers to the creation of what the FWP hoped would be kind of a new national narrative about the meaning and legacy of slavery and emancipation for the nation as a whole. So it was kind of an extraordinary moment where African Americans are being invited to speak with authority about those experiences, both firsthand and then also as African American employees of the Federal Writers Project who are working as interviewers and writers and editors, also being, you know, allowed and enabled to draw upon their expertise to talk about these issues for the first time to a national audience. And yet a moment that, because of the 1930s and the racial politics of that era, a moment that was deeply conflicted, if you will, in terms of the goals and the possible outcomes of this project and this endeavor.
And so one of the things that you point out in your book when you're talking about these ex-slave narratives and sort of setting them up and, you know, introducing them to the reader is how you read them in terms of, you know, you point out that you're, you know, earlier on, you were talking about, you know, the wide diversity of topics that are covered and how they're covered and everything like that. And but you're not exactly trying to, you know, create a catalog of like everything that's discussed in these narratives. You look at them in a very particular way and you read them in a very particular way. And so can you tell our readers how you do this and why that's important?
So I really wanted to take a look at this repository of ex-slave testimony for what it has to tell us about the 1930s and the time period in which it was created. Most scholars have drawn upon this rich resource to really help them rewrite histories of enslavement and what happened with emancipation and Reconstruction. But I was really intrigued by, again, kind of seeing on the page what these exchanges between Federal Writers Project employees as interviewers and informants who were formerly enslaved African Americans, what these conversational exchanges had to reveal about the context in which they were created of the 1930s. So one of the things I did is I really wanted to kind of excavate the various voices that I think show up in the written record, if you're reading carefully. And to, that is to say that as I was discovering, as I was looking at the history of the project, there are many different stakeholders, if you will, or many different groups who were invested in becoming involved in this project to collect ex-slave testimony, but who were putting their own spin on ex-slave oral histories and oral testimony, who had their own agendas to pursue, and who thought that they could pursue it through kind of shaping, editing, revising, influencing the stories and the histories of ex-slaves in this time period. So there's a number of ways in which you have different stakeholders all, again, kind of invested in telling their own story about Black citizenship, about the legacy of slavery, specifically through the narratives. And I wanted to see if reading the narratives themselves, again, with the knowledge of kind of how the project had evolved over time. So at the same time, I was drawing upon the enormous amounts of administrative correspondence that fortunately exist for the project, because one of the things that's great about New Deal projects of the 1930s is that they kept everything. So all of the administrative records and correspondence and the back and forth between local and state directors and federal directors is all there in the National Archives for scholars to look at. But I wanted to kind of use those two things in conjunction to see again if I could see the ways in which former slaves had shaped their stories in different ways, depending upon whom they were speaking to. And what I really thought, kind of going back to that idea of James Clifford and the predicament of culture and this kind of interest in anthropological exchange between anthropologists and their local informants, I really wanted to see if I could bring forward or make visible the power relationships that were involved in these exchanges and then show up themselves in the narratives that were created. So one of the things I wanted to think about was the ways in which formerly enslaved African Americans were in this situation of, in different contexts, of being interviewed by a variety of different types of interviewers of different racial backgrounds, both Black and white interviewers, the ways in which they were shaping their own stories, depending upon the listener. And I wanted to look specifically at these narratives as a type of oral performance. So I was intrigued to think about kind of the ways in which African Americans were strategic storytellers in terms of the ways they were relating their own narratives, and really kind of explaining why you do have interviews specifically where former slaves are talking about, again, kind of the good old days of slavery versus, you know, interviews where there's quite a bit of testimony about the brutality and the violence of the system. So I'm intrigued in kind of this idea of oral performance and how you have this kind of situation of live interaction between interviewers and ex-slaves who are being asked to kind of tell their life histories. And I was interested in the ways in which a number of former slaves were drawing upon African-American oral traditions. African-American oral traditions of storytelling, but also African-American oral traditions that are kind of summed up by the term signifying. So signifying is this idea, or specifically this concept of African-American oral tradition or vernacular tradition, that is a language of indirection and a language, or if you will, a rhetorical practice of implication. And so it's a way very often of saying the truth or expressing a certain truth, but coding it, but kind of creating it, covering it, if you will, cloaking it, if you will, using humor, using indirection, using figurative language very often. And so as I started to analyze kind of the narratives themselves for signifying, for evidence of African Americans using oral traditions in this in exchange with FWP interviews, I found a number of ways in which they were drawing upon these traditions specifically to tell their own truths in contexts where they knew that they were being faced with a white questioner, with a Southern white interviewer very often, who was not interested necessarily in hearing those particular truths about the institution of slavery. So I found a lot of ways in which African-American informants in this kind of context of being interviewed about their experiences found ways to tell the truth of their experience, but again, wrap it or cloak it, if you will, in language, in terms that would have been more acceptable to a number of Southern white interviewers who were not, well, let's put it this way, who were particularly invested in an image and a representation of the institution of slavery as, again, a benevolent institution, and who were particularly invested in, again, this romanticized, heavily mythologized idea of wonderful, close relationships between enslavers and enslaved African Americans. So I was looking kind of to see evidence of those signifying practices. I should say that signifying and kind of that term for this series of kind of oral performances or drawing upon African-American oral traditions is something that the novelist and the writer Zora Neale Hurston was actually one of the first to kind of term or talk about in her own writing. She was a professionally trained ethnographer. She had worked with the renowned anthropologist Franz Boas, and she was a very skilled and gifted ethnographer in terms of collecting African-American history and folk culture. And she ended up being employed, as were a number of kind of literary luminaries of the time. She was employed by the Federal Writers Project and was also engaged in kind of collecting Black folk culture in this time period. So she writes about signifying as this type of practice, as this type of oral tradition that African-Americans very often would draw upon when faced with kind of hostile white questioners. I'm trying to think, she talks about it kind of as, I think she uses the metaphor of kind of a featherbed mattress, that when faced with kind of white questioners who are hostile to what you might have to say or the truth that you might want to reveal, that African Americans would let the probe enter, but in this kind of featherbed, you know, it gets smothered, right? The truth gets smothered or kind of muffled, if you will, under laughter and pleasantry. So again, it's kind of a mode or method of being indirect, while at the same time making sure that your own truth is recorded. So my argument is, if you can, and I found evidence of signifying throughout the slave narrative collection, if you read carefully for those patterns of oral traditions and humor and indirection, and you're sensitive and are attuned to signifying practices as they might appear in these narratives, you can find the ways in which ex-slave informants were creating counter-narratives, if you will, counter-narratives of the history of slavery and emancipation, very often narratives that directly contradicted Southern whites' investment in kind of Confederate mythologies of the good old days of slavery. And you can find the ways in which they're writing not only their own, or telling, if you will, their own life histories and the reality and truth of those histories, but then also, as I said, kind of creating, if you will, strategic counter-narratives to make sure that their voices and their truth and their experience would be put in the historical record, even when, again, they were trying to shape it specifically for the person who was listening or the person who was asking those questions.
And so kind of speaking about, you know, the kind of the larger context of what's going on, that, you know, you have these white Southerners who have their own kind of vision of what slavery looks like that might be in competition with the formerly enslaved people's vision of what slavery looks like. What is the sort of kind of larger historical context of this moment outside of, you know, what we just talked about with the New Deal and the Federal Writers Project, the sort of kind of larger racial historical context that would make the ex-slave narratives, as you put them, a sort of case study for whether emancipation was even successful? And so kind of what's going on there, and how are the ex-slave narratives at this time kind of perceived this way?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And there's kind of two different ways of answering it, as always, with great questions, or multiple ways of answering it. One is specifically to think about, as you said, kind of the time period in which these were created. Because of what's happening in the 1930s, because Jim Crow segregation is still rampant, not just in the South, but also throughout the nation in northern areas as well, because African Americans are still struggling mightily for equality of economic opportunity, for political enfranchisement, for even social equality, as it was termed at the time. Really struggling, continuing to struggle through various civil rights movements and organizations for the rights of citizenship, which they should have been and were by rights granted by the Constitution, because all of that is still a moment of great racial inequity and inequality. The ex-slave narratives and really the ex-slaves themselves, for a number of different people involved in the Federal Writers Ex-Slave Project, become, if you will, the proving ground, kind of become the way of assessing or evaluating to what extent was emancipation successful, to what extent were African Americans considered fit or ready for the full rights and responsibilities of citizenship, obviously coming from a white perspective on that issue of whether or not equality should be finally enacted. And so the ex-slaves and their narratives really kind of become this site where different Americans from different backgrounds are really working out ideas about citizenship, about freedom, and about power. And I can give you kind of just a quick little example, if that's helpful, to kind of make it less abstract. But as I mentioned, one of the really surprising, I guess, and interesting finds that I discovered during my research was the fact that a number of Southern white interviewers were members of the organization known as the United Daughters of the Confederacy. The United Daughters of the Confederacy, also known as the UDC, was established in 1894. It was one of a number of Southern white organizations established in the decade following emancipation and kind of throughout the Reconstruction era that were really focusing on writing a national narrative about slavery and emancipation that was from the Confederate perspective, really trying to memorialize and consecrate, if you will, kind of in national memory, the idea of the lost cause. So that would be, in short, the idea that, again, slavery was a benevolent institution, that it was necessary. It would also be the idea that the Civil War was actually, in some cases, as they like to put it, a war of Northern aggression. Actually, to this day, the United Daughters of the Confederacy also prefer the phrase the war between the states as opposed to the Civil War, because they really were arguing and trying to imprint upon the historical record that the Civil War was not about slavery, which we do know it was about because we have the documentation of that, but specifically that it was not about slavery, that it was about states' rights. And again, this idea that it was really kind of a slavery itself was kind of a beautiful institution that worked effectively for Southern whites as well as for enslaved African Americans. So I discovered that a number of FWP interviewers were members of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, and the United Daughters of the Confederacy had been working since its formation in 1894 into the 20th century to really, again, imprint on the national narrative this idea of kind of the Southern mythology of the lost cause. And they found various ways to do this. They had essay contests and they wrote biographies of Confederate heroes. They erected a number of statues, which I'm sure most people are familiar with because of the ongoing debates today about whether those statues should remain in certain places. And they also then were engaged in creating very often what they called faithful slave narratives. They like to record what they saw as kind of firsthand testimony of former slaves that would talk about kind of the good old days of slavery. So you can imagine that some of the interviewers and then also in a couple cases, state directors of the FWP, of the Federal Writers Project, who were involved in the Ex-Slave Project, were very invested in taking ex-slave testimony, in gathering ex-slave testimony for this project that would, again, reiterate and authorize, if you will, from the mouths of former slaves themselves, this idea of kind of the lost cause mythology of the Confederacy and of kind of the Civil War. And so they were interested in kind of getting answers to the questions that they were posing that they were hoping would, again, emphasize this idea of faithful slaves, of faithful, happy slaves, contented and well-treated by their enslavers. So that was one kind of constituency. One of the other things that interested me in the ex-slave narratives were the ways in which African Americans as writers, and in one case, actually as a federal director for the Federal Writers Project, in the case of Sterling Brown, who was a poet and professor of English at Howard University, and who, thanks to kind of the advocacy of civil rights organizations, who was then the only African-American appointed to the position and the authority of being a federal director for the Federal Writers Project in the time. I wanted to kind of look specifically at what their experience was like with the project. As I mentioned at the beginning, it was kind of an unprecedented invitation for African Americans to speak to a national audience and participate in the creation of a national narrative about the legacy of slavery and emancipation. And African American employees from every level of the project were very eager to be able to have their voices amplified in this way. And many of the employees of the Federal Writers Project, and I can talk a little bit specifically about the ones I looked at in the state of Florida, who were part of a very important segregated Negro writers unit that also included the illustrious and brilliant genius Zora Neale Hurston. A lot of those writers and interviewers for the FWP who were involved in the project really saw this as the opportunity to, again, fight racism, fight discrimination in a time period when African Americans were really being denied their basic rights as citizens. And the ways in which they hoped to do that was to use the Ex-Slave Project and their participation in it to put forward portraits of African American character and identity that would contradict white racial supremacy, that would contradict racial characterizations and stereotypes of African Americans as somehow racially inferior and unfit for citizenship. So a number of those African American writers and interviewers were really striving not only to get the voices of ex-slaves and their firsthand testimony down for the historical record in terms of the brutality of the system, but also in terms of African Americans' constant struggle for liberation, in terms of their constant struggle during enslavement and then after emancipation to find a way to move forward from the legacy of slavery. And they were very interested in creating portraits of African Americans that would focus on this concept of racial uplift, that would show African Americans as capable of assimilating into American society, that would show African Americans as successful participants and longtime contributors to the establishment of the American nation. And so they had their own viewpoint in terms of trying to promote images and identities of African Americans that they helped, that they hoped would, similar to the Harlem Renaissance kind of efforts, that they hoped would finally persuade American whites of African Americans' readiness and fitness and rights of citizenship that were so deserved in this time period.
And one thing that I found very interesting for in your study is how you discuss the actual instructions that interviewers have and why that's important to how the ex-slave narratives kind of develop, and then how you kind of how you're reading them and everything like that. And so can you give our listeners an idea of what these instructions looked like and why they're so important for your study?
Yeah, so as I said, the wonderful thing about studying both this project and then really all the New Deal projects from the 1930s is the wonderful documentation, the very careful documentation and keeping of records in terms of how these projects evolved and developed. Now, both for the American Guide series and then also for the Ex-Slave Project, as you can imagine, federal directors in Washington, D.C. are trying to oversee projects that are happening in almost every state, in almost every region and location. And they were concerned that they would end up getting material that would be too widely divergent, you know, that they'd be having all kinds of bits and pieces coming from different interviewers and different writers and different perspectives and then being sent forth to the federal office, and that there wouldn't be a sense of I don't know. I don't want to say homogeneity because that's not what they were looking for, but a sense of cohesion, if you will, to all of these pieces that were being written, you know, in different little cities and areas, and then at the state director's offices, then sent on and edited and then sent on to the federal office. So they were interested in sending out guidelines, and they were also aware that they were hiring, you know, a range of writers, some with a lot of experience, some who were journalists, some who had been novelists, some who had very little experience necessarily, partly with this type of writing. And they wanted to create a series of federal guidelines that would assist, particularly with the collection of ex-slave testimony. So some of their manuals and directives that they start putting together and sending out to state offices and then also local offices specifically had to do with, you know, how do you find an informant, right? And then specifically, how do you go about getting them to tell you what they know, getting them to tell you their memories, getting them to trust you enough to be able to record their own life experiences and their life histories. So some of those manuals and federal directives were very basic in terms of just kind of talking about good interview techniques, talking about being able to put the interviewee at ease, trying to develop a rapport with an ex-slave informant. Many of the federal guidelines suggested that interviewers go back more than once to the same informant, again, in the hopes of kind of getting more information from that African-American interviewee. So a number of the federal guidelines focused on those kind of methods, if you will, of gathering information. And then as they started receiving more and more ex-slave narratives that were being sent on finally to the federal office, they also became concerned about the way in which they were being written down. So as I said before, you know, some of these narratives, if you look in the collection, are written kind of in the third person as kind of brief biographical sketches. Some of them, a lot of them actually are written in the first person, in the voice, attempting to recreate the voice of the ex-slave on the page. Those that do that really showed a wide range of very often Southern white listeners' ideas about Black speech, and specifically the ways in which they heard or misheard African-American versions of vernacular speech. And so the federal directors became enamored, not so much Sterling Brown, as I said, who became the director of the Office of Negro Affairs and who was the only African-American employed at the federal level. Not so much Sterling Brown, but many of the other directors, particularly John Lomax, who may be familiar to some people because he was one of the most important collectors of folk songs and folk culture and folklore during the 1930s and 40s. And he became the Folkways director for the Federal Writers Project. John Lomax in particular, and also Henry Alsberg, were very interested in having the narratives seem as if it was just the voice of the ex-slave speaking. So they were interested specifically in this idea of being able to hear, as you read, being able to hear the voice of the ex-slave informant. Because of that, they were encouraging state directors and employees to write up those narratives in that first person voice, you know, as they were hearing it. They were also encouraging them to try to be as accurate as possible in terms of writing down what ex-slave informants told them, even though much of that writing down also took place once they'd gotten back to the office and were looking back over their notes. And they were really encouraged to write it in some manner that would capture the unique qualities of certain aspects of African-American speech traditions, really trying to capture kind of idiomatic expressions and phrasing. Unfortunately, what that meant to a lot of Southern whites who were going out and kind of gathering these ex-slave narratives was this idea of phoneticized spelling to try to recreate what they thought or what they referred to as a Negro dialect on the page. And a lot of that phoneticized spelling to try to capture those elements of Black folk speech ended up actually creating kind of a defamiliarizing process where you're really kind of recreating a sense of essential racial immutable differences literally on the page. And not actually doing it very effectively in terms of actually being honest or accurate about how African-American informants were actually speaking. So when you do look at the kind of what one writer has called the I dialect that shows up in that type of writing, where you're trying to kind of give voice to rural, elderly Southern African-Americans, she calls it I dialect. EYI, you know, kind of an ocular representation, a visual representation of Black speech on the page, really had much more to do with Southern whites' ideas as they've been influenced by vaudeville traditions, as they've been influenced by minstrelsy, as they've been influenced by what they thought Black speech sounded like and what they thought it should be represented as on the page. So federal directors were very concerned then that you have all kinds of, you know, odd spellings coming in, all kinds of misplaced prepositions, and the ways in which, you know, there was such great variation in terms of Southern whites' attempts to record African-American oral traditions and speech on the page. And so they sent out guidelines specifically on how to spell certain words, how to spell, you know, dialect that they should be avoiding when possible, phoneticized spelling that wasn't necessary. So, for example, many Southern whites would spell was, you know, if I was said I was going, they would spell W-A-S as W-U-Z. As you can tell, that actually was and was sounds exactly the same. But on the page, it has the effect of, again, really emphasizing African-American speech as unlettered, as untutored, as something other than standard English. And again, many of these Southern whites were really invested in this notion of essential racial differences, in this idea of immutable racial differences that were manifested in what they thought of as Black racial inferiority. And they thought that that racial inferiority also was represented in Black speech, and that that should be recorded on the page. It gets interesting because, you know, federal directors were also receiving narratives that were written in the voice of the ex-slave that were also just in standard English. And the federal office and directors, particularly John Lomax, who was so interested in folk culture and Black folk expressions particularly, he was very disappointed with any narratives that were written in the first person but came forth in what would be called standard English. And so there was a lot of encouragement actually from the federal directors' offices back to state directors to always submit ex-slave testimony and narrative in a type of, you know, again, what was referred to at the time as a Negro dialect, just to give us the sense of authenticity and to give it the sense of local color and local flavor. So people like Sterling Brown, who, as I said, was the director of the Office of Negro Affairs, he had the unenviable task of being the sole African-American in a position of federal authority for this project, and his office received all of the copy that was coming forward from state projects having to do with African-American history, culture, and identity. And his tiny office, he had like three staff members occasionally, not always at the same time. That tiny office then under Sterling Brown was responsible for trying to review and correct kind of the worst misrepresentations of Black culture, of Black speech, of Black identity that were coming forward from state projects. So it was an enormous undertaking, and there was a lot of corrections, that had to be made. So Sterling Brown in particular, you know, is a professor of English. He was a poet. He was very attuned to the interesting aspects of idiomatic expression from different regions for African Americans in different areas. And he was particularly alarmed by this type of I dialect that kept showing up in a lot of Southern white submissions that, again, was really emphasizing this notion of Black racial otherness and really not paying attention or accurately representing in any way the way in which African-American informants were speaking. But what I was going to say is that some of the federal directors like John Lomax were so invested in this notion of kind of the authenticity of the first person narrative always being written in a type of Negro dialect or spoken in that way, that state directors who were submitting narratives that were written in standard English very often felt that they had to explain why they were doing so when they did so. So they would submit narratives that were written in standard English, and they would say, I know that the federal office really wants all of these to use Negro dialect and expression, but unfortunately, this particular ex-slave informant is very well educated and well lettered and didn't show any aspects of kind of vernacular folk speech that we could record. So there, it's complicated to talk about just because there were so many kind of evolving ideas over time, even though it takes place over such just a few years of the project from 1936 to 1939, even within that short span of time, very quickly, federal directors are kind of evolving in their ideas about what type of standardization needs to take place in this project in terms of the types of narratives they want submitted, the types of questions they want asked, how they want these written up, how they want them edited. And again, differing ideas even at the federal level in terms of the best way to go about representing Black folk speech on the page.
While the Federal Writers Project went throughout the entire country looking for ex-slave narratives, one of the places that you look in detail is Florida. And so why did you choose to look in detail in Florida, and what might have set it apart from other places?
Well, Florida is such an interesting case study because it was actually thanks to Florida and the Florida Project that was under the direction of Carita Doggett Corse, who was serving as the Florida State Director. It was Florida that had first kind of created a number of ex-slave narratives that were sent on to the federal directors in Washington that really garnered the attention of federal directors like John Lomax and Henry Alsberg. So Carita Doggett Corse became the state director of the Florida Project right at the beginning of the start of the FWP in 1935. And within just a few months of becoming the state director, she has this vision for creating a separate unit that would be composed entirely of African-American writers. And she herself was completely enamored with Zora Neale Hurston. She was aware of Hurston's kind of rising stardom as a writer and ethnographer. Zora Neale Hurston, at the time before she was hired on to the Florida Project, had published Their Eyes Were Watching God. She had published a seminal and really important ethnography on Black folk culture called Mules and Men. And Carita Doggett Corse had this vision of having a separate unit specifically for African-American writers that would be headed under the directorship of Zora Neale Hurston. Now, that didn't actually ever play out that way, and I'd be happy to talk about why Zora Neale Hurston does come and work for the project, but she never actually becomes director of the separate unit. But it's kind of, I would say, Carita Doggett Corse's vision for having African-Americans employed specifically to cover and collect and gather and write about Black history, culture, and identity, and specifically gather ex-slave narratives that really, as I said, kind of captures the attention of the federal office. And it's after their receipt of the narratives, the ex-slave narratives from Florida, that they decide that they're going to create this separate ex-slave project. And it's after the receipt of those Florida narratives that they end up sending out letters to other Southern state directors saying, we've gotten these great ex-slave narratives from Florida, and we would really like to undertake this same enterprise in your project as well. So even though a number of other states had already been out gathering occasionally an ex-slave narrative here or there as part of kind of the American Guide series, for some reason it was Florida's ex-slave narratives that really caught the attention of Henry Alsberg and John Lomax. And then the other aspect of Florida, as I mentioned, is that Carita Doggett Corse, unlike many other Southern state directors at the time period, was very invested in having African-American writers and interviewers involved in the project from the get-go. In a number of other cases, unfortunately, and you see this in the administrative and federal correspondence, state directors are very discriminatory in their hiring practices. And even though they're not supposed to be, in many cases, they do not want to hire African-Americans as workers and employees in the Federal Writers Project. And it's only through extreme pressure that's applied from the federal directors that they finally do start hiring African-Americans for these positions as interviewers and writers and editors. But in Florida, Florida was one of three states in the South to create a separate Negro writers unit. Now, even though separate Negro writers units obviously were created because of segregation And that was the idea, was that, you know, you couldn't have African-Americans and white workers, you know, working in the same office space. And that was one of the reasons that many Southern state directors gave for not hiring more African-Americans, is that you had no place to put them where they would be properly segregated. Even though these separate Negro Writers units came about as a result, obviously, of the racial segregation of the time period, in many of the cases, in three of the cases, as I said, Florida had a wonderful Negro Writers Unit, Louisiana and Virginia also had very distinguished Negro Writers Units. In those cases, surprisingly, I found that because of their separate status, because they had a separate unit, that in many of those cases, African-American writers in those capacities were able to make a greater contribution to the Federal Writers Project in terms of the collection and writing up of Black history and culture than African-American employees who were not hired as kind of a separate unit. So it's kind of one of the ironies of the history of the project and racial segregation. But Florida had a Negro Writers Unit that, again, was experiencing a great deal of racial discrimination even within Florida. And I could talk a little bit more about that, but they certainly were able to create and write up more of a portrait of African-American history and character and experience, including ex-slave narratives in Florida, than other states where African-Americans were not being employed as kind of a separate unit. The other aspect of that is that the other benefit, unintended benefit of focusing on Florida, is that I was able to do an oral history myself. And so the book is about kind of a history of oral history that took place in the 1930s. And it's about the kind of practice of oral history and the problems and methodology of oral history. But I myself had to have that experience firsthand because I was able to go interview in Florida Stetson Kennedy. Stetson Kennedy was a human rights activist, and he was also a central employee of the Florida Project. And he was still alive at the time that I was conducting my research. And he was able to actually tell me firsthand about what it was like to work with Zora Neale Hurston. Stetson Kennedy had been hired by Carita Doggett Coarse as a, you know, white Floridian. To be the head of Folkways and Life Histories for the Florida Project. And so he could give me firsthand kind of testimony about what the project looked like as it played out in Florida, and what were some of those conflicts that happened over kind of Southern white visions of the past versus African-American portraits of the past. And one of the things he did when he took me on kind of an oral history tour, if you will, of Jacksonville, he took me to Jacksonville to show me where the central office headquarters had been, where Carita Doggett Coarse was working, as the state director, and where he himself was working as the director of Folkways. And he took me to a building which in the 1930s was a brand new office building called the Exchange Building. It was this, you know, in the 1930s, this beautiful, glossy new office building. And that's where all of the Southern whites who were in Jacksonville working for the Federal Writers Project were doing all of their office work. And then we drove less than a mile across town to the Clara White Mission, which is still there. And at the time was a charitable African-American organization in the 1930s that functioned in multiple ways for the Black community of Jacksonville. It was a soup kitchen, but it was also an important community center. They had childcare available there. They had classes and all kinds of things. They were also then, as a mission, providing important office space for African-American employees who were not allowed, because of the rules of segregation, who were not allowed to work in the Exchange Building. So, you know, right within less than a mile across town, you have the Exchange Building, which is housing all of the Southern whites working on the Federal Writers Project, and then less than a mile across town at the Clara White Mission, thanks to the Clara White Mission, there's a limited amount of space available for the members of Florida's Negro Writers Unit who are all working there. And Stetson Kennedy told me that every 2 weeks they would have to send a messenger from the Clara White Mission over to the Exchange Building to gather up the paychecks for the members of Florida's Negro Writers Unit and bring those paychecks back to the Clara White mission. Zora Neale Hurston, because of her celebrity, was actually the only African-American who was ever allowed to visit the exchange office and the state headquarters in that district office. And even when she came to visit, Corita Doggett Course had to kind of prepare the staff made up of Southern whites to let them know that a special exception was going to be made for Zora Neale Hurston as a kind of African-American author and celebrity. So it was very interesting getting to talk to Stetson Kennedy, and that was one of the real advantages there. I'm giving you more material than you need, but one of my experiences of doing oral history in Florida, you know, was similar to kind of, I think, some of the struggles that employees of the Federal Writers Project encountered when they're trying to go out and kind of meet strangers for the first time and quickly develop a rapport in order to kind of get these strangers to tell them personal details and personal history and kind of gather important information. Stetson Kennedy had by mail, by correspondence, agreed to meet with me. And I had my little research grant, and I went down to Florida for the first time, really, to kind of explore that option, and had planned to meet with him the next day to start this kind of oral history of the Federal Writers Project and his memories of it. And, you know, he seemed to get cold feet at the last minute. And so the day that I called him, he told me that I would actually have to meet with his fiancée, Sandra Parks, at the time. And I could tell that she was going to screen me. You know, it was going to be through this kind of third party that she would assess whether or not I was worthy or reputable enough to be able to be granted access to Stetson Kennedy to gather my oral history interview with him. And that turned out to be, you know, a mitzvah, if you will. That turned out to be a fortuitous experience, because Sandra Parks was an amazing, still is amazing personage in Florida, but she really put me through my paces. So I went to meet her at her bookshop, and then she insisted that I actually take part in the reenactment of the British occupation of Florida, which happened to be taking place that day that I was in Florida. And she had a reenactor's costume that had been specially made for her that she insisted that I wear. She's much taller and thinner than I am. And so I squeezed myself at Sandra Park's behest into her outfit. And then I actually, for the first time and last time, took place in a reenactment, kind of living history reenactment, if you will, walking through the streets of St. Augustine at night to kind of commemorate this moment of British occupation. So that was an experience where I knew that I had to do everything that Sandra Parks suggested, just in the hopes that I would then be granted access to Stetson Kennedy. And to my great good fortune, I guess I proved my mettle, and Sandra Parks gave me the go-ahead. And from then on, Stetson Kennedy was incredibly generous and forthcoming in assisting me with my research.
Well, that's certainly a trial in and of itself, trying to get the material.
It really was. It was a real challenge, but it ended up being a real joy and obviously a great story afterwards.
So we have this great book in front of us, you know, once again, Long Past Slavery, Representing Race in the Federal Writers Project by Dr. Catherine A. Stewart. And I would encourage our readers to all go out and read and hopefully buy this book. But we have this in front of us. And so once we get through this, what can we expect to be seen from you in the future? What might you be working on now?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. What's great about doing one project is that very often, if you're fortunate and kind of paying attention, it can lead you to your next passion and your next obsession. And that happened with this project. So right now, I'm still grounded and kind of working within the New Deal framework, because I find it such a fascinating time period in American history for multiple reasons. And I'm still very much interested in the racial politics of the 1930s and the obstacles and limitations that African Americans were facing and struggling against during this time period. And so this time I'm still looking at the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, but I'm looking at a different project. And that was a project specifically put in place for women. The idea of trying to figure out ways in which women could find work. And part of that idea of the women's division of the WPA was to provide professional training for women who could then become domestic servants. So it was this idea that, you know, women's occupations, you know, were a limited range of opportunities in the time period. The idea was that if the WPA created, and they did, household training projects that would put women to work both as educators, as trainers, and then also as people taking those courses and getting that certification, that that would in and of itself, they hoped, help raise the status of domestic work, which was considered, you know, certainly kind of an unenviable job and task, and really a stigmatized in many way occupation, occupation in this time period. And they hoped that by having professional training programs in place, that it would elevate both the status of that occupation, and then they also hoped it would elevate wages, which were terribly low for domestic workers, household workers in the 1930s during the Great Depression. So it was the government's attempt to kind of, you know, create programs that would assist those workers. Certainly, one of the things I'm finding in my research is that, unfortunately, these kind of goodwill efforts to create certification and training programs and hoping that that in and of itself would encourage employers to give raise wages and raise salaries for those workers didn't really work out the way that they hoped. But I'm very interested in how this intersection, if you will, of kind of the economic crisis of the Great Depression, the racial politics and struggles of civil rights organizations during the 1930s against segregation and attempts to create equal opportunity in this time period, intersecting with that economic crisis, and then the federal government's attempts to also engage and try to solve and address various issues that are raised by this economic crisis, how those things come together in this fulcrum, if you will, that is kind of the social, economic, and kind of political crisis of the 1930s. So I remain kind of really committed to and really interested in this nexus of, if you will, race and class and nation in this really troubling and critical moment of possibility in American history that is the 1930s.
Well, that certainly sounds interesting, and I'm sure once that work is completed, we'll have you right back onto the program. But in any case, thank you very much for coming on today.
Oh, thank you, Derek, so much. It's been a pleasure.